You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rebecca Winthrop. I'm the director here at Brookings of the Center for Universal Education. It's a real pleasure to have all of you. Today we are talking about education in Pakistan. I'm sure you are all intimately familiar with both those things, but just in case, you know, one of the reasons that we in particular are quite focused on Pakistan within our work in the center is because it's an important country, a very populous country, a young country, a country with very low human development indicators in a very unstable region, 185 million people, two-thirds of whom are under the age of 30, and 40, by the best sort of estimates, 40 of the 70 million school-age kids in Pakistan are not even in school. So huge problems. And those that do get into school, often the quality of schooling is really incredibly poor. And there's a range of statistics around that, but, I think Micah will probably cover some, but one that always sticks in my mind is at least in Punjab province, which is the wealthiest, most prosperous, province with the best sort of educational attainment, over half of the kids in third grade can't read. There are deep sort of problems within education. And for us at the center, human development is a driving concern of our work. We care about education, you know, intrinsically. It's a right for all kids, but particularly because we know it's very important for sustained progress for countries, both in terms of the knock-on effects of health and lifting people out of poverty and economic growth and development and building skill sets for the future. But we also care quite a bit about the intersection and the relationship between education and security and education and stability. And for us, we think about this in two ways. You know, one is how does insecurity or violence in whatever form it is, in the case of Pakistan, militancy in other countries, armed conflict, et cetera, how does that phenomenon affect education and education outcomes? And there is a wide body of literature and work we do around that. Attacks on education is certainly one. Keeping kids out of school is another. There's a whole range of issues. The case of Malala, the girl who was shot in the bus in Pakistan just for going to school, sort of is a symbol of the impacts of violence and militancy on education. But secondly, we think about the intersection in a different way, and one that gets quite short shrift in our opinion, which is the ways in which education, the processes of education, can actually intersect with and either help or hinder what in the development lexicon is often a set of processes termed as state building or peace building. And there's a bunch of ways education does this. A couple, just to mention, because I think it's particularly important for the discussion today, is around governance, how education systems are governed and managed. Education, probably more than any other social sector, is highly visible and highly symbolic. In Pakistan, there's about, in my last count, I could be off a bit here, but 750,000 public government teachers, which is about 100,000 more than military personnel. There's a school in every town, or there should be a school in every town and village, and people have the expectation that the government should provide schooling to their kids. So when teachers don't turn up, or they take bribes for exam pass rates, or a whole other host of poorly governed education management issues, it really affects people all over the country in terms of their trust in the government, in terms of their faith in their own future and their ability to sort of progress in the country. Another piece, of course, is education, unlike other social sectors, is very influential in identity formation, whether it's the language that we pick to educate people in, whether it's who gets access to schooling, who doesn't, the content of the curriculum, what history is taught, what sort of social narratives are taught. These are all, for decades and decades around the world, have been things that different social narratives, different political ideologies, different groups have battled within the education sphere. Certainly has happened in Pakistan, but by no means limited to Pakistan. It happens certainly also here in the United States. So that's our interest in a snapshot of our work. And today, we're going to be talking about, some of the good news that's coming out of Pakistan in the education sector and potentially in the political and security sector. We rarely hear about it in the U.S. All, you know, media coverage is often about all the bad things that happen, in Pakistan, but there are lots of good things happening quietly. Progress is being made in different ways. And I'm really, really pleased, to have with us, three distinguished speakers. We have, Sir Michael Barber, who's the chief education strategist from Pearson. And we have Iqbal Noor Ali, who's the senior advisor of the Aga Khan Development Network. And then we have my good colleague, Bruce Rydell, who's the senior fellow, a senior fellow here at Brookings and the director of the Intelligence Project. And we, what we're going to do first, Michael, you'll come up. You'll tell us about, some of the interesting progress that's being made, on education in Pakistan. And then the rest of us will come up and we'll have a discussion with all of you. And one of the closing thoughts, I don't know if anybody has gotten a chance to grab this, but this is the report on, the progress that's been made in the last 2 years, in education in Pakistan that Michael will talk about, that he and very, very closely with the government has been, intimately, involved in moving forward. And for me, the interesting thing is that you'll see from the presentation, been huge progress in the last 2 years. And one of the reasons that I think, people who care about state building, peace building, security, stability, often pay too little attention to the education sector is because actually this is one area where good policies, good data, good leadership can actually make a huge difference in a very short period of time. So it's an area where that we can affect in terms of policy, unlike it's much harder to affect a range of other issues that feed stability and security. So with that, Michael, why don't I turn it over to you?
Thank you, Rebecca, and thank you all for coming. It's really great to be at the Brookings Institution, and thank you to Brookings for putting together such a fantastic panel and a wonderful group of people to discuss this agenda with. I just want to say a couple of words by way of introduction. It's true what Rebecca says. I am the Chief Education Advisor for Pearson. That's my day job. The work I do in and Pearson is very supportive of the work I do in Pearson in Pakistan, but I do it on behalf of the British International Development Department. It's unpaid work that I do roughly 30 days a year, although it takes up a lot more of my headspace than that implies. It's actually the most rewarding thing I do and maybe the most rewarding thing I've ever been involved in. The publication that Rebecca mentioned is what I'm going to talk about. It's called The Good News from Pakistan for the reasons Rebecca gave. It's really important that people understand that there is some good news from Pakistan. We did a presentation a few weeks ago in Stanford for largely the Pakistani diaspora on the West Coast, and at the end of it, they were coming out and said, this is the first time we've heard good news from Pakistan for a while, if ever. Actually, there's a bit more good news because the election went really well, and there's a lot of sense of hope, not just on education, but more generally now in the sense, partly that the election went well, partly there's governments with a majority and or significant chance of effective governance in several of the provinces and at national level, and partly because the electorate seems to have, on the whole, rewarded politicians who delivered and thrown out politicians who failed to deliver. And that is a good sign anywhere in the world, actually, and a sign of democracy becoming embedded because it's moving beyond patronage towards delivery. And what I want to talk about is the way we've approached the education reform in Punjab. And just for completeness on the election, I was there last week, so I had this sense. I met probably all the key people in Pakistan in a small number of days. And the roadmap that I'm about to describe is very much on track. The same chief minister is back in Punjab raring to go. We were talking about what goals we should set for 2018 so that we can take the roadmap forward. And before I go into the data, I just want to say one other thing by way of introduction. However good this looks, none of us involved think that this is a finished job. We know that it's not irreversible. We know that if we stopped doing this, things could slide back to where they were 2 years ago. So we're not claiming sustainability or irreversibility. We're claiming really good progress over 2 years. But nobody should get the impression that this is deeply embedded, irreversible, and going on. We have to keep focused on it to make it happen. And the Chief Minister is totally aware of that. If you look at the data from some Indian provinces that made progress in the last decade, like Madhya Pradesh, you'll see it rises, and then they change policy, they change Chief Minister, and you get this plunge in the results. That could happen in Punjab, or could have happened. I now think there's a really good opportunity that we will see this through. And we're talking about, boldly, about phrases like getting to Malaysia by 2018. That's the kind of aspiration, so that we can really create an education system that is irreversibly moving forward into the 21st century. And for all the reasons Rebecca gave, that is very important for the future economy. It's a very young country. If you had a well-educated population, the country could really thrive in the next 50 years. If you have a badly educated problems, a population, there will be economic insecurity and many other problems. Last word by way of introduction. I'm going to take you through the policy that is embedded in the education roadmap in Punjab, and I'm going to take you through the processes that drive it. Both are important. And I suppose what I want to do is remind people that however difficult it is in any government to get the policy right, and it is difficult, that's only 10% of the task. 90% is implementation and processes that drive implementation. Many politicians around the world get that the wrong way around. They think getting the policy right is 90% of the task and implementation will take care of itself. The roadmap is a pretty simple set of policy prescriptions systematically implemented through a set of processes that I and other colleagues around the world have been involved in developing over the last few years. The president of the World Bank now calls it the science of delivery. I rather self-mockingly call it deliverology. But either way, it's a science of getting things done, and it's an emerging science. It's not a perfect science. But what we now know from Britain and from Ontario and from Malaysia, Sierra Leone, among others, a number of US states, incidentally, that the science of delivery, if applied systematically, makes a huge difference to the outcomes in a relatively short space of time. So that what I'm going to present has implications not just for education policy in Pakistan, but for aid programs and for governments more generally. When we started on the roadmap, there were lots of problems with the education system in Pakistan. You can see the state of some of the textbooks in this picture, not to mention the school. This is a school in the far eastern edge of Punjab, very near the Indian border. Nobody learning much, desperately trying to hold the books together in the breeze, outdoor in the sun. Rebecca gave you a statistic. There are many other statistics like that. Lots of children out of school. The children in school not really learning. More than 20% of teachers not there on a given day. Corrupt officials at various different levels. Teacher transfers based on sort of political manipulation rather than anything to do with quality. So that was the starting point. And what the Chief Minister leapt on back in the latter part of 2010 was the idea that he could make a significant difference in a two-year period if he applied the policy lessons from other systems like his in India, in South Africa, in Brazil, and then applied a systematic approach to delivery. And he decided to do that in October 2010. We began the implementation of the roadmap in January 2011, and that first phase between January and August 2011 was about building the infrastructure for delivery. And then from August 2011, we began implementation school by school. Pakistan is a place that has crises quite often. Every country has crises. Pakistan has more than its fair share. This is the floods of 2010. I went back to Pakistan after those floods. It was a huge trauma. It was biblical proportions, literally. More than the surface area of England was underwater. It was absolutely devastating. I met a set of officials who I'd been working with prior to that from around Pakistan, not just Punjab. They said, we can't do education reform anymore. We've had a flood. I said, you have to be ruthless sometimes. Did the flood make your schools better? if the flood didn't make your schools better, we've still got the challenge to do. And part of deliverology, or the science of delivery, is never being deflected from the task. If the schools are important, if the education of the future citizens of Pakistan is important, then it doesn't matter what crisis you have to keep doing it. When we started implementation in September 2011 in Punjab, there was an outbreak of dengue fever across Lahore and surrounding regions. We still carried on with the roadmap. We still carried on with implementation. We didn't let those crises deflect you. If you let the crises deflect you in Pakistan, you never get anything done. And governments around the world have learnt that lesson. There was a Russian prime minister who retired after 2 years in office in the 1990s, a wonderful man called Viktor Chernomyrdin. And when asked about his term in office, he said, "We tried to do better, but everything turned out as usual." Lots of politicians have had that experience. But by getting the focus on the policy and the implementation, you can avoid that fate. So what are the elements of the roadmap? Well, here is a pretty simple way of doing it. The first thing is, for the province of Punjab, we set targets. How many teachers did we want to turn up on an average day? How many children did we want to get into school and by when? And so on. So very basic targets. And then we split those targets up among the 36 districts, and we made sure that each district person, the EDO and the DCO, the overall leader of the district and the education leader of the district, knew exactly what they were meant to achieve by 2013. So we had province-wide targets broken down into district-wide targets and a trajectory to go from 2011 to 2013. Simple stuff. Everybody knows what they've got to do. We then put in place a data system building on some good work that the World Bank had done prior to the roadmap, education roadmap, to make sure that we got monthly data from every school. 60,000 government schools across Punjab, every one of them we get monthly data. The May data for this year will be in Lahore by 2 days from now, so the 7th of June. And by next week, myself, Fenton Whelan, who's here and part of the team, we'll be able to analyze that data. We'll be able to share it with the chief minister, share it with the top officials, and then the following week it will be back in the 36 districts. Every district chief will know how their district compares on that data to every other district in Punjab. So very rapid cycles of data collection, analysis, and getting it back into the system. Very important. Second thing, district administration. Corrupt officials are being removed. So we now have 36 EDOs, one in each district, appointed by on merit by a committee chaired by the secretary of schools, no political interference. There was a bit of shuffling around of these officials during the election campaign because some of the political parties were worried that if they stayed in the districts they were in, they would manipulate the vote in the favour of the current chief minister. So they got reshuffled, but they were all actually, in fact, appointed on merit, and now we hope that most of them will stay in the districts they've been reshuffled to. So getting good people appointed on merit and keeping them in post, very simple but absolutely fundamental. Anybody who knows Pakistan knows that in large parts of the bureaucracy, you get this incredible turnover of officials that prevents you from getting anything done. But in Punjab, at district level and in the centre in Lahore, we've had a stable group of officials who have done a wonderful job. The secretary of schools, a wonderful official called Aslam Kambo, said publicly recently that at the beginning of the roadmap, he was the biggest skeptic about the whole program. He thought it was going to be just another aid initiative, in his words. Now he's the biggest fan. He will be promoted soon, probably. He's been there 3.5 years. He said to me last Friday, as a result of working on the roadmap, I am a different official. So really good people, and we train these people. Every 6 months we do very interactive training, not generic capacity building, but training to do this job at that moment over the next 6 months. Very focused, very inspiring training. We have a strategy on teacher quality. 81,000 teachers have been newly appointed in Punjab, all on merit over the last 3 years. The teachers in post are now managed, so they're turning up 92% of the time instead of just under 80% of the time as of a few years ago. They've all got lesson plans for grades 1 to 5 in English, maths and science. New textbooks have gone into school. They were meant to go in April. They'll get there finally, totally, this very, actually they should be in there by the end of May. So they should be there now, all the new textbooks. And then we're piloting a new system of teacher quality where each teacher has support from a mentor who visits the classroom once or twice a month and offers coaching on how to improve it. So again, it's not taking teachers away to some training centre where they get harangued, which is the old model of training in Punjab. It's focused at the classroom level. We've piloted it in 2 districts. It's now in 9 districts, and we hope over the next year to take it to all 36 districts. We've already got evidence that it makes a difference. The enrolment drive, we've made progress on enrolment, adding something like 1.5 million children to the rolls in the last year and a half. It's not enough. We want to try and get another 3 million extra children into school in this year. We were hoping to make real progress in April, but it was difficult during an election campaign. But in August, September and October, we will have a big enrolment drive. We talked to the Chief Minister about it last week. He will personally lead that enrolment drive. We'll treat it as an emergency and a crisis, and we'll drive progress on that. And we've done everything down to a very specific guide using cartoons and pictures translated into Urdu for each teacher who has to go out around the school, find the children, and bring them to school. We know, for example, that if you want, first of all, you need a new map because every place in Pakistan is getting bigger because population growth is so rapid. But then you need the teachers to go, and to get the girls into school, the teacher needs to go with a girl child, go with the textbook, say, look, this is the kind of textbook. Look, the school is different. And look, here's a girl child who goes to school and she likes it. Why don't you come tomorrow? And that way we can find the children and get them into school. So all the big global stuff about getting into children and children into school is, in the end, it's all about the detail. It's what you do at the ground level, on the front line, in the dusty streets of the villages of Punjab. And then there are a whole range of additional supporting programs, which I won't go into. The Punjab Education Foundation is a key part of this. We have a voucher scheme currently with 150,000 children on vouchers. They can take the voucher. It's 500 rupees a month. They can take it to any low-cost private school that's registered. Those vouchers only go to poor parents whose children are out of school, and we will build that voucher program up over the next 5 years so that something like 800,000 children who would otherwise have been out of school now get into school as a result of that, particularly in remote areas where the government systems either aren't present or don't work. There's a big media campaign run by Jio, the largest media conglomerate in Pakistan, encouraging people to get their children into school. Those Pakistanis among you will be aware of the wonderful music of Shehzad Roy. He's done a whole a song specifically to promote this whole education thing. He's done a 24-part television series in which he rides around looking cool on a motorbike but stops off and interviews people about education. He's changed the law in several provinces on corporal punishment as a result of that campaign. And then there's a whole innovation fund, which, again, I won't go into because I want to stick to my time. I said that the routines were really important as well. What makes this work? First of all, leadership commitment. Shahbaz Sharif has been really fantastic at leading this, consistent all the way through. Having a team on the ground, Saad Rizvi, Fenton Whelan here, were members of that team at different times. It's been absolutely fundamental having a team working with the officials, helping them do all the things that get done. Reviewing the roadmap actions, checking on the front line, going to visit schools and checking that it is actually working. It's not just the data you're relying on, you're seeing it with your own eyes. A regular stock take that I do every 2 months with the Chief Minister where we review progress. We have the Secretary of Finance, the Chief Secretary, the Education Secretary in the room, and we review progress. We make rapid decisions. We act on them. We've got a routine that drives delivery. We're not just responding to crises. And then absolute discipline, never giving up, always focusing on delivery. And these are the things that make delivery work. I'm not going to go through the slide. You can all have the presentation. But basically, delivery is about answering 5 questions. What are you trying to do? How do you know? How are you trying to do it? How do you know if you're on track? If you're not on track, what are you going to do about it? And can we, in this case, the delivery team, help to get that done? It's as simple as that. It's the rigor with which you do it that makes the difference. I just want to show you a few examples of the kind of data. So I mentioned the monthly data. Here's an example from September 2011. Bahawalpur is a big district in the southwest of Punjab on the Indian border. Every one of the 36 districts gets that. So you can see the targets down there, teacher presence, student attendance, teacher guides, and functioning facilities. You can see what Bahawalpur's performance was on each of those. You can see that this is sent to the EDO, that the education official in charge of education. You can, he or she can see, in this case, she can see where they should have been, where they should be aiming to be in November, and then they can see exactly how many extra teachers to hit the target. So they were green, so they hit their September target. To get the November target, they got an extra 25 teachers across the province, across the district, into school to hit the November target. But they were really poor on student attendance in September 2011. So they've got to get 14,741 students on that. So we're making it really easy for them to see what the task is. If you went scrolled down, you'd find the names of the head teachers, the names of the schools that were not delivering, and sometimes the phone number of the schools. And all the EDO has got to do is call them up and say, get five more children into school next month. We make it easy for them to do the job. This is delivery in action. On the key actions that we report in the stock take, the Chief Minister sees the actions. There's numbers 32 to 39 on priority 4 listed, and we rank the, we say, are they green? It's been done. Are they amber green or yellow green, if you're an American? In which case, they are largely done, but there's a problem. And sometimes they're amber red or red. There's a problem. In the stock take, we're going to solve that problem. We won't leave the stock take till we know what we're going to do to turn that green. It's my job, my personal job, to judge whether something's green, red, or amber, or in between. Because if you're an official in Punjab, it's hard to report bad news to the Chief Minister, because it's difficult. But for me, it's straightforward. So I make sure the conversation is honest. The officials often try to persuade me to turn things green because it will make their life easier in the stock take. I tell them the only way to turn it green is to do the action. So what are the results? Well, all of these things are true. Higher enrollment, more teachers attending than ever before, more schools with better facilities, stronger administration, focusing on improving quality. So that's actually happening. I won't go through all the data because my 15 minutes is almost up, but I want to show you the kind of graphs we use in the stock take. So here's one showing we check whether district administrators are actually visiting the schools. If you go back to August 2011 when we began, 22% of schools were visited in the average month. Now it's 96% of schools. If you summarize that, basically a system that was unmanaged is now managed. That's vital. A lot of delivery is really boring. It's just about doing the job. As a result, we've got lots of children into school, as I mentioned. We can break it down by urban and rural, north, central, and south. So if you go to the far side, you can see that in urban northern districts, 95% of girls and boys are attending. It's pretty much the same in rural districts in the north. But in the south, we have a real problem with enrollment with girls in the deep south. So only 67% attending. So we can break this data down. We can do the same analysis at district level. These are the heat maps we use. The Chief Minister, when he first saw these, said, I'm going to sleep with these under my pillow. He loves these maps. He can see, in this case, this is enrollment. We do a six-monthly independent survey of enrollment, not controlled by us, not controlled by the government, independent survey. We see where enrollment is high and where it's low. We focus the resources, the attention, the energy on the red bits. And in the enrollment drive for 2013, those districts in the southwest, the tribal areas in the southwest of Punjab, will get by far the most focus from our team, from the administration, and indeed in terms of resources. Student attendance, I won't go through all these things. I just wanted to give you the flavour. All of these graphs you can have. They're actually all in the document that is being handed out. And sometimes the heat maps are less red than the one you saw before. Facilities having only 68% of schools had running water, electricity, a boundary wall, and toilets back when we started. Now it's over 90%. And teacher presence gone from 80% to 92%. These are the teacher quality pilots I mentioned. Look at the big improvements in the pilot from teachers using a lesson plan, using activities in the classroom, and using questions to check learning. So very basic elements of pedagogy that make a difference. The new textbooks I mentioned, and then the vouchers. So it's gone from 2,000 children having vouchers to 140,000. Actually, we just got the new data. It's now 150,000, and next year we'll add another 50,000. This is really important to getting the enrolment of people in remote parts of Punjab into the school system. And finally, here are the lessons. Be ambitious, set clear goals, prepare, plan, and get on with it. Don't get the plan perfect, just get started and refine it through the routines. Establish those routines that I mentioned, the stock take being the centerpiece. Make sure the conversation is honest. It's been my job so far, but increasingly everybody joins in that conversation. Really know what's happening, not just the data, but look at the front line. Refine constantly, but don't compromise on the ambition. Create momentum. Momentum is everything. And by getting the monthly data and seeing the change, you get this sense that we can really make a difference. People get excited, engaged, persist even when there's a dengue fever outbreak. Build a guiding coalition, a growing number of people who support this. Started with the chief minister and a handful of people. Now there's a much broader coalition politically, administratively, and indeed in parts of the public for supporting this. Focus on the change that needed. So decide what you want to do and work back to the money. Lots of aid programs start by focusing on the money and how to allocate it. Focus on what you want to achieve. Come back to the money. And finally, when all else fails in Pakistan, you can always talk about cricket. This is easier for the British than the Americans. And in fact, it could be said to be one of the major flaws in American foreign policy. But with that in mind, I just want to go back to the beginning. This is not a finished job. It's just started. Over the next 5 years, we're going to try and get to Malaysia. Thank you very much for your time and attention. One more thing. My Twitter handle is on there. There's a lot of debate about education in Pakistan and on Twitter.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you, Michael, for that impressive rapid-fire walkthrough. I think we can all be very impressed with the progress that's made in such a short period of time. What I wanted to do is ask a few questions of our panelists, and then we'll throw it up for debate and discussion with all of you. And Iqbal, I thought maybe I'd start with you. Michael presented basically the fruits of a UK aid program in the last couple of years, which have been very impressive. And your organization, the Aga Khan Development Network, has been working on education in Pakistan for decades. Almost, actually, maybe a century, you told me recently. So, you know, could you give some reflections both about, you know, your thoughts about the reforms that Michael is talking about, but also some of this longer-term vision about education reform in Pakistan, and about the role, perhaps, of non-state actors? We heard quite a bit about what the government can do, and I know, Michael, you didn't go into it in great depth, but part of the voucher scheme for reaching kids, poor kids in rural areas where there isn't a lot of government schools, is to partner with non-governmental entities to deliver services. So it'd be interesting to hear from an organization that's been doing that for a long time.
Can I just correct one thing?
Yeah, please do.
So I don't think of it as a British aid program that's done well. I think of it as a Punjab government program that's done really well, supported by
well,
corrected. It's a very, very important distinction.
Yes, thank you. Anyways, I'm a big fan before I let him speak, I'll say I'm a big fan of the Aga Khan Development Network's work on education in Pakistan. I've visited it several times and have to say that the best girls' education program I've ever seen in the world was up in Gilgit-Baltistan with AKF. Anyways, floor to you.
Well, good morning. Thank you, first of all, for inviting me here. I'm honored to be in the company of people who are experts, not only on the subject of education, but about the country where I was born, people normally assume I know a lot about the place where I was born, and I don't, and these people know a lot more. So I feel daunted on the one hand and secure on the other that I'm in great company. And thank you for giving me the option to talk a little bit about the AKDN and its work in education. You're right, the first schools were set up in pre-partition India, which Pakistan didn't even exist, in 1905, well over 100 years ago. In fact, the very first school I went to was an Aga Khan school, and it wasn't quite 100 years ago, but that was my first school. It started, I guess if you want to trace it back, it is, you know, the role of the Aga Khan as the leader of a community, which he inherited from his grandfather, Sir Sultan Muhammad Shah Aga Khan, who back in the 1880s, when advising his community, told them that if you have to choose between, if you have limited resources and you want to choose between educating your sons or your daughters, educate your daughters first, because that will give you a strong grounding for the future of the family. And I often tell the story about how my mother was better educated than I am because her parents followed the advice and she could read, write, and speak five languages, and I barely manage one. And if you imagine that she was educated in the 20s and the 30s, that was quite a while ago. So we can talk a little bit more about that, but let me just congratulate Sir Michael on the work that really his leadership and the political will of the leaders in Punjab is making possible. And as you've rightly pointed out, it is the beginning, but it's a very august beginning. And one wishes Godspeed and full progress with it. But what I got out of reading the report and out of what was said this morning is that you need political will. You need vision.
Yeah.
You need a visionary leader. And in the case of the government, you have one. Now in the case of the Aga Khan development, we've been very fortunate to have that leadership continue for well over 100 years. The ability to stick to the long-term goals. I mean, there will be ups and downs along the way, but you got to remain focused on goals. And I think so far in the 2 years, this project demonstrates that very well. So clear objectives, a results-oriented approach. I almost look at it as a business venture, that you're driving it. If you had a business startup, and I come more from a business background and a development background, you drive for results, and you simply innovate along the way in order to overcome the obstacles and find solutions. I also see in it right now it is with the Punjab Education Foundation, it's a public-private partnership, but I also see a public-private community partnership. Mm-hmm. Emerging out of it. It's a notion and a concept that we in the Aga Khan Development Network, both in Pakistan and elsewhere, support very strongly, because eventually the community has to buy into it. And I can illustrate that with an example in education, for instance, in a valley called Nagar in the northern areas that you might have visited. Mm-hmm. I remember driving to Nagar, which is across the valley across from Hunza, and the two communities there were at odds with each other for decades, if not centuries. They were killing each other, basically. And I remember going there in the early 80s sometimes, a few years after the Aga Khan Rural Support Program had been established and had come into that village. And our sort of cars were stopped by villagers on our way to Hunza, where a group had gathered and said, here is the land, we want you to come and build a school here. That transformation took place, if you look at it 30 years ago, the enrollment of girls from Nagar was only 4%. Today it is, I believe, 92%. There were no schools that girls could go to at the time. And now there are primary schools that still don't have high schools, but the parents have gotten together and they transport their children over to Karimabad to send their girls to high school there. And 70% of them stay in high school. The role of the community is important because a non-state actor or even the government, and I'm not claiming that the Aga Khan Education Services did it by itself because the government was involved, the other programs were involved, have helped change the attitude of the community. Mm-hmm. And eventually for anything to use that often misunderstood word sustainable is for the community to have a role in it. And I see the emergence of that in the program that has been described by the Punjab. I think the value of in-service teacher training, because basically when you're reaching out to teachers, you're making them part of the ownership of that program itself. It's something we've learned doing in Gilgit-Baltistan and Chitral, and it's effective because in many cases, girls especially are not allowed to go out to study somewhere far. So you bring the mountain to Muhammad, so to speak. You bring the training within the classroom where they can learn practically about what are the issues and how to deal with a better pedagogy. So in the 5 minutes, I want to touch on two other things. One is our success in girls' education that I think we're all very proud of. The other is the trailblazing role that the Aga Khan University has played in bringing private sector higher education to Pakistan. Mm-hmm. At the invitation of the government back in 1983, the Aga Khan University was established as Pakistan's first private university with very clear objectives, and that would be a one-hour presentation if I went into that. But one of the objectives was to be a role model and to focus on quality of education. It was the first private university between Suez Canal and Japan at that time in 1983, so I'm told by my colleagues at AKU. What it did was it opened the doors for other private sector players to enter in the higher education field in Pakistan. And you have some very good universities now, LUMS that you work with, the Lahore University of Management Sciences, and several others. There's about 60 of them, 59 or 60 of them now. And one of the other things that the Aga Khan University has been able to tackle among different issues in education and so on was the system of examination. They set up an examination board that was approved by the government in 2003, 2004, as an alternative to the government school of examination, which was corrupt, which was not credible, which, you know, if you came to this country or some other with a certificate of education from Pakistan was not worth the paper it was written on. I remember a friend of mine applied for a job here recently with a bank, has tons of years of experience, but doesn't have an MBA, but he happens to be from Pakistan. And he asked, the recruiter offered the job and then found out he doesn't have a master's degree. He said, "Well, what kind of master's degree do you need? I'll get you one from Pakistan." So, you know, I mean, that...
And did he?
No. and the recruiter said, "Thank you." Either Pakistan or some other country, said yes. The point being that the examination system lacked credibility, and there were many flaws in it. One of the biggest ones was that the examiners were preparing them from a testing standpoint as opposed to the curriculum. Students were not being tested on what they had learned, but were being coached in order to pass an exam. And all kinds of things sort of went on there. So that is one of the success stories, and I think it's catching on and has become a good alternative. But what it's also doing is, by osmosis, the government examination system is adapting some of the methods that the Aga Khan University Examination Board has adopted. And that's changing the whole system of how testing is done. And I can stop there for now and talk more.
We'll carry on, yeah. Yes. Thank you so much, Iqbal. Yeah. Bruce, can we turn it over to you? You of course, are well known for your expertise on security in Pakistan and the region, and you just have a new book out on Pakistan, India, and the U.S., I gather. But you also, in every time I've heard you speak, you talk quite eloquently and strongly about human development and education in particular, particularly as it pertains to women and girls, and the role it plays in stability and security. And so I'd be curious if you could talk to us a little bit, you know, about the other good news. You've written some blogs recently on the elections, but, you know, what's your take on the status of the country at the moment? And then where do you see some of this progress, quiet, ongoing progress that Iqbal is talking about, or recent, very recent big systemic progress that Michael is talking about in the education sector interfacing with the security context?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me here, and it's a pleasure to be here with these very distinguished colleagues. When Rebecca sent me an email about a month ago saying that she was going to do an event entitled Good News from Pakistan, I said, "I've got to be there." It is so rare. We've got to seize on this moment. And I think it's almost impossible to overstate the importance of this. Pakistan is a nation under siege. Since 9/11, 45,000 Pakistani civilians, police officers, and military personnel have been killed in acts of terrorism and acts of militant violence. That's the equivalent of a dozen 9/11s in the United States in the same period of time. The militancy, the violence, targets the educational system. It was no accident that Malala was the target of an assassination campaign. The Pakistan Taliban saw her for what she was, a threat to everything that they want to do. So this is a country under siege, but it's also a country, I would say, at a crossroads, at a very, very important crossroads. And we've alluded to it, but I think we need to be more specific about it. This election, for the first time in the history of Pakistan, over 65 years, a democratically elected civilian government filled out its term in office and then had another democratic election and a new civilian government took its place. These elections were not perfect. They were not flawless. But there is no real challenge that they, in the end, produced the results that the Pakistani people wanted them to have. Turnout, despite the threats of militant violence, despite over 140 terrorist attacks and somewhere around 97 other acts of political violence, turnout was remarkably high, especially in the Punjab, but in other places as well. People were told that not only should they not vote because it was against Islam and Pakistan Taliban's version of Islam, but that it wouldn't matter. And yet they turned out and they voted and it did matter. The other very important thing about it is that the new government, the Nawaz Sharif PML government, has a real mandate. They have a majority in the parliament. That majority is likely to grow as people see a winner and want to join on the winning ticket. This provides Pakistan with a chance for some real change and real new decisions, which then comes to this report. As Sir Michael has eloquently laid out, it's all about leadership. And here the leadership comes from Chief Minister Shahbaz Sharif. Shahbaz Sharif is a very well-known quantity. He's been a central player in Pakistani politics for a long time, and so is his brother. And one thing that we know is that it is a team. Nawaz and Shahbaz are a team. They work together. One of the things I discovered in the Clinton administration working with Nawaz is his second term as prime minister was just how important to his thinking was what his brother told him in the privacy of the two of them working together. And that's very good news. If the Sharif brothers have understood the importance of education in Punjab, if they've understood the chance, the opportunity that was given to them here to work with this institution, that augurs well for what a third Nawaz Sharif prime ministership will look like. What did he run on? What did he say he wanted to do as prime minister for the third time? He emphasized education and he emphasized infrastructure. And those are exactly the right things that Pakistan needs in the future. One doesn't want to get carried away. Pakistan still has huge problems. The relationship between the Pakistani army and the Pakistani civilian government is one that we will have to see how it develops. Nawaz and Shahbaz are, after all, acutely aware of this problem, since they've ended up spending a good part of their lives in exile because they didn't get it right the last time. Nawaz is one of the key challenges he faces is picking the new chief of army staff. Needless to say, he chose poorly in the past. He's not alone. A lot of Pakistani leaders have chosen poorly in the past when it came to choosing chief of army staff. Probably no one more poorly than Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, who ended up paying for his life for a poor choice. But it's easy to be pessimistic about Pakistan, and it will take you nowhere. It is much more important to be hopeful about Pakistan and hope that this study, these developments in the Punjab augur for a change in the future of the country, and I think that's a good reason to have come here today. I can't stop, though, without making one other shout-out. You rightly noted this is not a British government program, but I do think that we ought to give some credit to former Foreign Secretary David Miliband, my good friend, for having been an inspiration in making this happen. And if he has no other legacy as British Foreign Secretary, and he actually has quite many other legacies, this will be one of the most important.
I think that's it. Thank you very much, Bruce, and that's a perfect segue, Michael, to see if you have any sort of reflections or last comments before we open it up. I had two questions on that. hearing what Bruce just raised about sort of the importance and the heft with which the UK government has engaged in this process. Yes, thank you. It's early on, it's early days, you emphasize that, but over the long term, what's the sustainability sort of plan here? In particular, there were two things that I was interested to hear your thoughts on. One is you kept saying, you know, it's very difficult to talk honestly. There's incentives within a bureaucracy for, you know, district-level officials not to tell the truth to their chief minister. And you said part of the success is you, an external actor, you who are there to work closely with the government, was able, you know, no skin off your back. You can talk honestly if they don't like you. The worst thing is you stop working on it. It's not the end of your job. You're not, et cetera. So how do you make that transition? That was one key question. And the other question I guess I had is this something that you think can take on in the other provinces in Pakistan? Punjab is exceptional in some ways.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'll be very brief. Yeah. Thank you for the comments to both the other panelists. And I just want to reinforce where Bruce finished. David Miliband started this. He and I had worked together in Downing Street earlier, back in the previous decade and before Blair was elected. He was a great foreign secretary. He really cared about Pakistan. I think he's the only foreign secretary in British history that went to Pakistan more times than he went to America. He really takes it seriously. He still thinks about it. He was emailing me about it after my visit last week. So it's true. And by the way, this is a big element of quiet British, I was going to call it diplomacy. Britain is really interested in doing this, the education reform, and working with the Pakistani leadership to enable this to happen. On the two questions, I think the fear that some officials have of some politicians is not confined to Pakistan at all. I've seen it in British administration. Some ministers are challenging to be with. In the end, it's the way the civil service builds its culture. And I think what I'm trying to model, and hopefully people will develop, is creating the kind of conversation where you focus on solving the problem before you allocate the blame. Normal governments around the world allocate blame first and then solve the problem afterwards, but they get so caught up in the blame, often driven by the media, who's saying whose head should roll. What we tried to do back in the Blair administration when we were developing this delivery process, and what I'm trying to do in Punjab, is get the focus on solve the problem first. If there's blame to be allocated, just do it later. Sometimes there is, sometimes it's just the story. So I think you can build that capacity in a governmental system over time to get that bit right. I'm not pretending it's easy, and it depends on the individuals as well as the culture of the institution. But I'm impressed by the top officials in Punjab and some of the ones I've met elsewhere, and their ability to increasingly debate this. And I'm also impressed the way Shahbaz Sharif has moved on from, as he said in one of the early stock takes about somebody who was frustrating him, throw him in the Arabian Sea, to moving, he didn't really mean it, moving on to now focusing on solving the problem. So I think that's a matter of time. But none of these things are easily made irreversible. It is about building cultures focused on delivering outcomes, solving problems. Is it transferable to the other provinces? We hope so. And we're putting in place in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa the infrastructure that will make this possible if the newly elected PTI government decides to do that. I met their leadership last week, and they are enthused about doing this process. We will see whether they're ready to adopt it. But if we could get a kind of education roadmap adapted to meet the PDI policy, and then the focus on delivery that we've had in Punjab translated into Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, I think that would be a big step forward. So there's definite interest in doing that.
Great, thanks. So the floor is open. We'll open it up to questions for folks, and there's a mic going around. I see a handful. Let's start at the back, sort of one, two, the back on the aisle there. Yes.
My name is Arnav, and I'm an intern at Brookings. I live in India myself, and I think a lot of problems Indian villages face are also faced by some of the issues we discussed today. And something I noticed in India as well is a lot of families refuse to send their children to school because they feel that schooling is useless, because a lot of schooling does not translate into jobs. And they rather have the children working at home, supporting the family income and various other occupations. So my question is, from a policy standpoint, how do you think this perception can be changed in various households in Pakistani villages?
Okay, great.
That's a good question.
That might be a question for you, Iqbal, right here on the end. Yeah.
I think good news and bearers of good news are most welcome, especially on Mass Avenue where news...
Can you speak up a little? We can't... I think, yeah. Yes.
Good news and bearers of good news are very welcome, especially on Mass Avenue, where often news about Pakistan is very bad. You know, Britain has taken a number of excellent initiatives in Pakistan. I live and work in Pakistan, including DFID-funded IGC program, etc. My question is about what you call deliverology. You know, there are districts in, especially in northern Punjab, where you have very high literacy, and have had high literacy for a long time, yeah, without any gender, yeah, difference. What is it that we learn from those districts as we expand the delivery of education in the districts in southern Punjab, and how does that inform what you are doing?
Could you introduce yourself before we pass the mic on?
My name is Ijaz Nabi, and I teach at LUMS, and I'm based in Lahore.
Great. Thank you so much. And then we had a question here. Yeah. There, the blue shirt, and then we'll go to Hina at the end. Go ahead.
First of all, thank you for all the work you do. My name is Adam Sari. I'm with the Yale Journal of International Affairs, and I will actually be interning here at Brookings later on in June. My question is just about human resources. So there's been a lot of talk about the brain drain happening in Pakistan. There's a lot of talk about that there's not a culture of teaching, that people don't want to be teachers, rather be a business person. And there's also some kind of complaints that Pakistan has a huge diaspora community in Europe and the United States, but it hasn't really leveraged it properly. So overall, my question is, considering the brain drain diaspora and the lack of appeal to become a teacher, what challenges and opportunities do you see in the human resources sector in getting better teachers?
Great. And one last question here. We'll catch the others of the second round. I'll catch you next time. There's a very patient man there with us.
Hello, my name is Hanam Baloch, and I'm a fellow at Penn State University. My question to you is that you've worked extensively with PMLN, and you will be working with them more in the next 5 years. PMLN has been known to be a right-wing political party, and that is also known to have covert links with groups like Lashkar-e-Jhangvi and Tehreek-e-Taliban in Punjab. I'm just wondering, and Punjab is also a province where we've seen most violence against Christians, against Ahmadis, against other minority communities. Also, if we see the blasphemy prisoners in Pakistan, most of them are in Punjab. Now, all of those who've studied in Pakistan, we can say that a lot of this goes back to and can be traced back to what we've studied in our textbooks in Pakistan. And Punjab has tried a little bit to bring textbooks reform, but it hasn't really worked that well. How much do you think DFID or the U.S. government would be able to put some sort of pressure on the government this time to introduce some serious kind of textbooks reform? My second question is that aid work in Pakistan is highly political. Aid goes, unfortunately, to the strongest rather than to the weakest. Not that I'm not saying that Punjab doesn't have its problems, but there are also other provinces in Pakistan that have bigger problems than Punjab. I worked at an aid organization for 5 years, and it used to be a huge task for me to, for example, bring Balochistan in focus or try to divert some aid funding to Balochistan. How do you see that now that your model has worked in Punjab? How do you see sort of replicating it in other parts?
Okay. Thank you. Great. Thank you so much. So we have a question around community demand for schooling, which anybody can answer anything, but Iqbal, perhaps you could especially answer that. There was also a question around the sort of high literacy rates in the northern areas, but what do we have to show for it? Perhaps, Michael, you could talk on that. We also had, I'm missing this
one. Brain drain.
The brain drain, yeah. That's it, the brain drain question. And then this last question had several. One is about sort of the political nature of aid. Bruce, perhaps you can speak on that, as well as there's, and anyone is, please speak on this as well, this idea of the content of the curriculum in Pakistan and how that interfaces with militancy or militant attitudes or sort of looking favorably on violence, I think, was the question. So, Bruce, why don't we start at your end?
Sure. I think the question of how do you replicate this is an extremely important question. You mentioned Baluchistan. I would say to me the priority is how do you replicate this in Karachi? Because unless Pakistan can get its biggest city and its port city right, it's hard to see how this is in the end going to work. And Karachi is a really hard nut to crack. One of the features of this election that is disturbing is the way it's broke down on regional lines. The PML did extremely well in Punjab. The PPP did very well in the Sindh. And the MQM did very well in Karachi. On the standard of who is likely to promote the outcomes we want, I think we've gone in the right order there. How the Nawaz Sharif government deals with the problem of Karachi is going to be one of the major challenges in front of it. You raised the question of the party's relationship with various militant groups. It's a fact. It's a fact. I mean, Nawaz Sharif's birth in the political process and his brother's birth were as proteges of Zia-ul-Haq. We can only hope that the passage of time has convinced them that the policies of Zia-ul-Haq are not the policies they want to pursue in the future. As I said, I think there are, in this report, in the way the chief minister worked on it, reasons to be hopeful. Last thing I would say, the British government deserves tremendous attention and commendation for doing this. U.S. policy towards Pakistan, I think, is also at a crossroads today. We've had a rough 4 years. As the president acknowledged in his speech at NDU, relationship has gotten to be rock bottom. But he has also promised changes. My words, not his. He has decided to become a reformed drone addict, and we can already see that he is shooting up less. That augurs well for the capacity of the U.S. and Pakistan to see if it can turn a corner as we start what is now a new government in Islamabad.
Thanks, Bruce. Iqbal, any of those questions?
I think the question that was asked of me is about why would people, especially in rural areas, want to send their children for more education, because there are examples that have been cited where there's reluctance to it. It's a somewhat complicated answer. I think it comes back to what I hinted at earlier, is the community's involvement in its own development. We have done studies where we found that when women have access to income, for instance, they want more of it to go towards their children's education and health. So there are linkages. You cannot compartmentalize things. We also found in our development work in Pakistan and elsewhere, even in East Africa and in India, that villages are smarter than we give them credit for. When they see an economic benefit coming out of a certain action, they will not only buy into it, they'll want to lead it. So the business about community sensitization, awareness, and so on begins by having a catalyst that brings awareness to the community and not necessarily want to sell something to the community. Mm-hmm. Our experience has been quite different in the villages in the northern areas. Part of it has been policy-driven. For instance, we've had, for the lack of a better term, I would call it affirmative action towards girls' education. The Arkan schools there have had a policy that the ratio of girls to boys in our schools will be 65 to 35. And only in exceptional cases where there are no boys' schools available will the ratio go to 50-50, girls and boys, provided all the girls in the village have been admitted to school. So sometimes that kind of a policy discretion on the part of an implementer also helps. The other thing that we found creates that awareness is what we call the ladder of education. So we believe the education starts right from birth and goes on through university and tertiary care. So our early childhood development programs in villages already make mothers and fathers want their children to be better educated because they can see the results of that cognitive learning that takes place in the under two age. So there are multiple factors. I'm very optimistic. I think it is. If there are people who feel reluctant, it doesn't take very long for them to understand the value of education, and they then demand it themselves.
Great, thank you.
Just
Michael,
to comment quickly on Hina's question, first of all, on aid, although I described the work in Punjab, we're taking the same or an adapted version into Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. And then in Karachi, which Bruce rightly mentioned as a major challenge, because we don't believe that, we the British, don't believe that we can give aid to the Sindh government to do this because we don't think they'll spend the money effectively. In Karachi, we've built a new not-for-profit organization led by the business leaders of Karachi, given it some aid money, and that institution is buying places in low-cost private and NGO sectors for children who are out of school across Karachi. Karachi is the least well-educated megacity on the planet. We can't leave it. We can't neglect it for the reasons Bruce gave, but equally we can't use the government because that won't work. So this is a big innovation in aid. Already 18,000 children are benefiting from that. There's a voucher program just coming on board based on the one in Punjab. So we're not neglecting the other areas. And then in Balochistan, British aid working through other aid agencies is beginning to look at that. But that's not part of my work, and I agree it's important. On the other part of your question, you said that I work with the PMLN, and it's true that obviously the Chief Minister of Punjab is a PMLN person through and through. I just want to say that we work with the government of Punjab. That's the way I think about it. So it's not a party political. They're the elected government. We work with them. In Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, we'll work with the elected government, which will be PTI-led. So we're not, in that sense, party political. But the point you raise about textbooks historically is a very important thing. One of the things that Shahbaz has done in the last 2 years is visit a school in Birmingham in England, where it's a girls' school. Most of the children in the school are British Muslims. He was really impressed by it. It's a wonderful school, just an ordinary government state school. When he went back on a panel with me, on a platform with me, he harangued the journalists in the front row. He said, show me a school anywhere in Pakistan where we would educate Christians the way the British are educating Muslims in Birmingham. It was really, really impressive, actually. He didn't need to do that. So I think that whole mode of thought is moving on in a very, very significant way, and the textbooks will need looking at. On the north and south that Ijaz asked about, one of the things about these maps is it shows where the resource is needed. Now, you look at the map and you can see that you've got to focus your enrollment drive in the southwest. In conversation with the Punjab government last week, we talked about one of the goals for 2018 being to equalize education outcomes as far as we can between the north and south of Punjab, drawing on the experience of the north, but also recognizing the many differences there in resource and other cultural factors. That is a big challenge. If you take Italy, just to take a totally different randomly selected country, the north and south, even though they have equal funding, have very, very different educational outcomes. That's not an easy thing to take on, but the deliverology process enables you to see where you need to put the effort. Nobody mentioned the brain drain. I can't go into all of the questions you wrapped up in that, but I want to say this. There's never been a better moment for talented Pakistanis to go back and contribute to their country. This is a fantastic opportunity to go and do that. And on the parents and thinking school is useless, as you put it, that's true. So one of the things we do in Punjab is now say a new day is dawning, like on the slide, and we take that message out to the parents and say, why don't you look again? Because maybe this time your child will have a teacher and a textbook and a lesson plan and really learn something.
Great, thanks. And I wanted, before we go out to the next round of questions, I wanted to pick up on something that you raised a bit, Bruce, and ask all of you. We're talking about sort of the UK involvement in this process through its aid. I have a question about the US and the US engagement and development in Pakistan and in the education sector. Is the US involved in supporting the roadmap? If not, why not? Michael, you're here in D.C., certainly folks in the audience, some of them will be working with the U.S. government. What advice would you want to give for the U.S. government on that? U.S. aid is complicated because of the security operations, and I mean, Iqbal, I don't know if you have thoughts. I know that NGOs on the ground, some are more reluctant to partner with USAID and than other donors, perhaps. And Bruce, if you have any thoughts on this in particular, I'm sure you do. Michael, maybe you want to.
Well, as Bruce said, the relations were fairly strained between the US and Pakistan over the last 4 years, not just because Americans don't understand cricket, and there were lots of factors. And the Punjab government actually, in the pre-election period, refused to accept American aid. There is a new day dawning. There is a new government. There's a new attitude from the US towards Pakistan. And there's lots of reasons to hope that that progress that's been made in the last few months will be built on in the next few years. There's then a wider question about aid in general. Let me say two. One is there's no point Americans spending aid in the hope of being loved in Pakistan while, however few they are, drones are being fired into the country. You won't get loved for delivering aid while drones are still being fired in. So there's a whole issue there. The thing to think about aid is, are we investing in the future development of the country in a serious way, but don't do it to be loved? But then the wider question, which is for the aid community, not just the Americans or the British, is there's an awful lot of separate aid initiatives that actually get in the way of each other, many of them badly designed, many of them separate initiatives, building 30 schools here or a literacy program there or whatever it is. The roadmap is different. It's a, as I said, it's a Punjab government initiative supported by the British, but also the World Bank is in behind there, the Canadians are in behind there. So if the Americans want to get involved in Punjab, they should plug into the roadmap process. Otherwise, you just get a whole series of separate initiatives, or what one of my friends calls the helping hand striking again and again and again, like being slapped around the face. That just gets in the way of delivery. So now we've got a process. If the Americans want to invest in the future development of Pakistan, of Punjab on education, or any of the other provinces where we're doing this, they should do it through the roadmap in a collaborative way, assuming that the government of Punjab or elsewhere would like that support.
I'll come to the U.S. Government funding part of it, but may I just add a word on the
please.
Brain drain?
Yeah, yeah.
The example that was cited about teaching not being seen as a worthwhile profession, the analogy I can give you is about nursing. When we started the Aga Khan University, we started with the School of Nursing. And a lot of people asked, why nursing? Well, one, because the ratio of doctors to nurses was exactly the reverse of what it should be, so that was a need. But the nursing profession, which was predominantly a women's profession, was not considered of good status and so on. What we found over time, and in a very short period of time, is that by giving quality education to nurses and enhancing their social stature, you not only help them earn more money, but it's become a desirable profession. And I think the same applies to teaching. Teaching, even in our country right here, we have problems with. We need to see teachers in a better light. I remember every teacher that's ever had any impact on my life, and when I say my prayers, I either thank them or pray for their souls, because without them, honestly, I wouldn't be doing anything I've done, because there are people you remember that as teachers have an impact on your life. So the brain drain, yes, and I wish I could share Sir Michael's optimism about this being the best time for people to return to Pakistan. I will say inshallah, because we have that same issue. We have nurses, again, I come back to them. We lose half of them to the U.S. because they get better paid here, there's more security, they are more desirable as married partners for Pakistani men living here, et cetera, et cetera. We lose half the doctors that graduate from the Aga Khan University. And some of them, after having established themselves here, do want to go back, but they cannot because of the political instability and the insecurity. So hopefully, when that turns, a lot of good things will begin to happen. We've had funding from USAID when I worked at the foundation before this, and they've been good partners for us. In the post-9/11 era, it wasn't easy, I have to admit. But I also found that when you sit down and rationalize and reason with people, at USAID, they understand your constraints. One of the biggest ones we faced was where they insisted on branding, putting the USAID seal. Now, that's like setting up a target for someone to shoot at. Mm-hmm. And our early childhood development program was partly funded by USAID in Sindh and Balochistan. We worked in Balochistan, a very difficult place. And when you sit down and reason with them that here's a compromise, are you seriously interested in improving the lives of young children, or are you more interested in getting the logo out there? They will quickly tell you, do what you need to do. I found them to be very reasonable. They've supported us in early childhood, the examination board, which was controversial at the time. We had partial support from USAID in getting that started, and a number of other things. We've had a very good relationship with USAID over the years. So, but we find them to be, they have their own constraints. I will not say that everything's been rosy, but you can talk things through.
Well, I will just admit up front, I spent 2 years posted in London. And despite repeated efforts, I couldn't make any sense out of cricket. I found it incomprehensible. I couldn't figure out how you were scoring, and I didn't understand how you played some games one day and other ones took 2 weeks. It was, so if that's our challenge, I'm afraid America's going to fail. We're not going
to
make it.
Not to mention whether you're in or out.
Right. It's, on the question of U.S. economic assistance for Pakistani development. I think that there is, a lot of negatives about how the U.S. programs have been run. There has been a lot of friction with the Punjab government and USAID in Pakistan. We're at a crossroads. We're at a new day. We have the opportunity to try to do something better. I would urge the president in one of his early steps, now that the prime minister has formed a government, would be to invite Prime Minister Sharif to Washington for a face-to-face opportunity to see if they can't find ways to work together. We are going to differ. That is inevitable. We have profound differences over the future of Afghanistan, for example. And the drones are not going to go away. But we need to find ways within the realities that we both face to try to take us from the rock bottom we are in U.S.-Pakistan relationships today to something better. The good news is there's an awful lot of room to improve. The bad news is, unfortunately, it could also get worse. So it's a crossroads. It's a moment to seize the opportunity.
Great. Thank you. Let's do one last round. There is a very patient man here in a blue shirt. I called on last time, and he hopefully remembers this question.
Hi, University of Wisconsin. I'm a researcher, Colin Christopher. My question is about the quality of education. It's great news that we have more children in the schoolhouses, that the schoolhouses are actually having walls and water. Teachers are showing up more. Two questions. One is accountability of teachers showing up. Could you explain a little bit about the details of how the incentives for them reporting correctly? That's one of the problems that we've seen in the past with teachers not showing up and saying they did show up. And the other one is quality of education. We know that the quality of the teacher is the most important factor, input, and outcome of how a student learns, whether it's in Punjab or anywhere else in the world. Can you speak of how Punjab has attracted quality teachers? I know that's been a problem, especially in rural areas where it's difficult, especially for women, to live in these remote areas. If you could speak on those points. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Right here in the white.
Hi, my name is Suzanne, and I work with Teach for All, and Teach for Pakistan is one of our network programs. Building on the quality questions, I was interested in knowing more about the low-cost private schools and the voucher program, and how those schools have or haven't been a part of the roadmap reforms, and what you do to what mechanisms are in place to monitor the quality and hold those schools accountable that are receiving the vouchers.
Right. It's a question all the way at the very back, Elizabeth.
Hi, I'm Lisbeth Steer from Brookings. I thought the presentation was great in making a case for saying that progress is much more than about money. And we haven't talked very much about money, which is quite interesting. We talked about the role of donors, but we know that donors are ever more constrained and that they are likely to play a more limited role as time goes on. So the question is, what role could they most effectively play? And then how much is actually required from the governments? I'd love to know more about how you got the Punjabi government to raise more funding or to invest more resources in what you did. I assume they also contributed to it financially.
Right. One last question here, and then we'll just go straight down the line and feel free to answer any questions you like and any last words before we close.
Yeah. Sabra Qureshi, independent consultant. Thank you for all the good news we've heard today. A quick question, I think, following on from all the questions on quality. You talked about public-private partnerships also. We know that a lot of the private sector schools and some of the NGO schools are English medium, but the public sector is all Urdu medium instruction, although the government is trying to gradually move towards English medium for some subjects. Just a quick sort of thought on how this language divide continues to perpetuate some of the huge problems we see in Pakistan, and whether there should be a complete switch to English medium by the public sector also.
Great, thanks. So we have a couple of questions around quality education, particularly the role of teachers, accountability, as well as questions around language, another question around low-cost private schools, and then questions around donors' most effective role, and how much does this all cost? It's a good question.
Okay, so I'll try and be quick. There's a lot in there, and I'll try and be... On the quality of education, Teach for Pakistan, the issue is how to get a significant impact rapidly at large scale, given the challenges there, and I think that's what Teach for Pakistan should be thinking about. On teacher accountability, I showed the increase in monthly management visits to 96%. Also, the data collection process involves some people randomly arriving at a school and checking that the teachers are there. So the teachers are now, every school, somebody will randomly each month show up and see if the teachers are there. That's why we've got the big increase. We've squeezed the amount of discretionary time teachers that were taking off for things that are important in Pakistan, like weddings and so on, which take several days sometimes. And so we've squeezed that time down from like 25 days a year to more like 12 days a year, and making sure that teachers show up. And that's important. And then the teacher quality pilot that I briefly touched on is the way of getting at the quality of teaching. It's at a very low base, and we're really working on how to get some basic aspects of pedagogy, starting a lesson properly, using a lesson plan, using an activity, summarizing the learning outcomes at the end of the lesson. So we're at that level of improving the teacher quality. And then access to the teaching profession in Punjab is now totally on merit. And so over time, the teaching profession should be improving. I know that's a short answer to that needs longer, but we're running out of time. On the low-cost private sector, the vouchers are one of the schemes that the Punjab Education Foundation does, but there are two others, one setting up new NGO or for-profit schools in rural areas, and the other, the foundation-assisted program, which basically buys the places in a low-cost private sector and allocates them free at the point of use to the children who use it. If you add up all that, something like 1.2 million children are now in Punjab Education Foundation programs, which means the Punjab Education Foundation is a bigger educational delivery agency than Denmark, for example. That's a really important part of building the public-private partnerships. If you look at the total Punjab, there are 100,000 schools, of which about 60,000 are government schools. If you look at the proportions of children in low-cost private or government system, it's about 60-40 in the province. In Lahore, it's 30% in government schools, 70% in low-cost private schools. What we're trying to do is build a whole system reform that combines the energy of both. The question a chief minister or an education minister has to ask, and this would apply across India as well, is not how do I improve my government system, but how do I get every child in this province a good education as fast as possible, regardless of where they go to school. And then the last thing I wanted to say is on the donor question. The roadmap is not expensive in donor terms. It's about shaping the way the Punjab government spends its total education budget. The roadmap itself, Diffid gave this answer out recently in Britain, the roadmap itself has cost about £25 million. It's a really small cost to shape the way the Punjab government shapes its cost. the future of aid programs is to get that kind of leverage, to get the influence on the big money through building the right relationships with government, through supporting governments rather than running aid initiatives. That's how we're going to get big change for aid money. And obviously, and it goes into this in the good news in Pakistan, the goal of all aid programs should be to abolish themselves and as soon as possible. The British are actually increasing their aid money very significantly, and I'm in favour of that. But we've got to spend it effectively so that at some point in the foreseeable future, we don't need aid except in the case of humanitarian crises, because in the end you want governments to be effective and do these things for themselves.
Great. Thanks, Michael. Iqbal, any last thoughts or answer to some of those questions?
I think Sir Michael's covered them very well. On the quality of education question, yes, I mean, we work through various support programs, as you are, the Institute for Education Development, the Arakan University, the Professional Development Centers. It's constant upgrading of teachers and their skills and making them more competent professionals, because that's really what they are, that eventually improve the quality. And we have something called the School Improvement Program that, in addition to the 190 schools that we run, it supports 200 community-based schools and 100 government-based schools, where you work with administrators, where supervisors, as in the case of the Punjab, are taught to be more coaches and mentors rather than people who check off things on boxes on a sheet. I had one other thought on the role of donors that I wanted to actually advocate. It is the role in institution building. Because if you look at Pakistan from every perspective, whether it's political, financial, markets, education, and so on, why it lags behind in, compared to other countries is the lack of focus on building institutions. And unfortunately, the donor mentality, which I call the Wall Street mentality of looking for quarterly results, does not fit in well with institution building, which requires long-term commitment, a long-term vision, and staying the course. So if I was to advocate something to donors here and everywhere else, is if you believe in the long-term viability of Pakistan, invest in helping build institutions.
Thank you. Final word, Bruce.
The final word, I would say one other reason for hopefulness, one other reason for this being a crossroads moment is that the new Pakistani government, both brothers, have eloquently spoken about the need for détente and rapprochement with India. If Pakistan really wants to have a future, it needs to stop being obsessed with being the anti-India and develop its own identity as Pakistan. The dark forces in Pakistan, Lashkar-e-Jangva, Lashkar-e-Taiba, and others, will also know this is a crossroads moment, and we can expect them to try to sabotage all of it. The United States, the United Kingdom, will need to be alert and need to try to steer with the Pakistan government and the Indian government towards a better place in the future. It's easy to say all of that. The history of U.S. relations with India and Pakistan argues it's very difficult for America to be very helpful in that regard. But hope springs eternal, and today we've had a lot of hope. So we should go off for a change, thinking that maybe the future will be brighter for Pakistan and for U.S.-Pakistan relations than it has been in the past.
Great way to close. Thank you very much. Thank you, all of you.